Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, 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 check this out. This is Fresh Get Out the China Man with the 2 Live Crew.
Yo, yo, what's up, y'all? It's me, DMC.
What's up, y'all? This is the boy, Master B.
Yo, check us out. Chuck the Public Enemy.
Yo, what's up? This is DJ Yellow from the world's most dangerous group.
What's up? This is DLC.
This is your boy, C.
This is Jerry Heller, motherfucker.
This is your boy, DJ Paul KOL 365.
Young Dizzy Bomb.
Vice Womp.
Yo, this is DJ Reddy Red.
What up, what up, what up? This is the real Rick Ross. You listen to me on the Murder Master Music Show.
This is a show that shows no limits, broadcast nothing but the real. Interviews with legendary artists, still got love for the underground feel. Rappers with records revealing addition, and rappers are coming up, get them put on. We needed a platform to fight the mainstream. The show that you need to be on. Hit up UGS for life on screen and follow up wizard.com. For all of your needs, production and mixing, a master and graphics, just download it all. Check out the archives and touch with the shows. Plenty of content for you to do. Everything free to download this stream. Oh yeah, we deserve the real review.
We're talking about what we brought up, it's we represent. All them chillers on the mic and we should love to all you fans. Motherfuckers wanna hate, do your thing, you keep the focus. Bringing nothing but the rules to come and tune into the dopest.
I'm a man-made guy, crazy knocking all you rappers on this underground society. It's UGS yes, for life, dog, hip-hop, AD. Representing for them legends, rapping mumble rappers. So me, sitting on the hips. Two-pocket beats, dreaming, thank you for the bliss. It's the Murder Master Music Show. Free the homie gangsta crew. I see these rappers on these streets, I got my chop.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's your boy Prez, man. Welcome to Murder Master Music Show, episode 572. And we got legendary guest tonight who, is part of the reason why Master P achieved some of the success that he achieved. You know, what people don't understand is behind every legend, behind every pioneer, there's people in their corner. Just like me with Murder Dog Magazine. I wrote for them for 15 years. You know what I'm saying? I helped contribute some content. You know what I'm saying? We had a lot of people on the streets that helped us promote the magazine. We had a lot of people in different places that, you know, helped us sell advertising. So, I mean, it's a team effort. People think that, you know, achieving level of success is done, you know what I'm saying, by one person on their own. That's not the case. You know, tonight we got Tobin Costin. He's going to be our guest tonight, a legendary man from Cali who has a very unique story. I'm going to bring on the homie Lord Sinister over there in France, kind of give us a little bit of a background on Tobin before I bring him on. What's up, Sin? How you doing, bro?
Yeah, what's up, Scott? Yeah, we have a legendary Tobin Costin on the line, so... The general manager of No Limit Records back in the day, and Master P manager too. So it's a great guest tonight.
The early days of Master P, you're talking about the,
yes,
the Getaway Queen in a minute.
1990.
George.
1990.
Yeah. These are the albums, you know what I'm saying, that helped, you know what I'm saying, P go from one level to another level to another level. I mean, it was a progression, but without this beginning, it's kind of like early NWA records, early 2 Live Crew records. Without that beginning foundation, when Luke was selling records out of the back of his mother's house, you know what I'm saying, that is when he was building the fan base, you know what I'm saying? And most definitely. Let's bring on Tobin right now. Fam, how you doing, man? Welcome to the Murder Master Music Show. Such an honor to have you on the show, man.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys and being a part of the show and what you guys are doing. I love how you guys, you know, really take all the different levels of hip-hop and bring them to the world. So I really appreciate being a part of the process, you know?
Man, thank you. Thank you so much, man. The archive is full of different people. All aspects of hip hop, you know, just like the Ghetto Boys, you know what I'm saying? Their success, it wasn't just from Jay Prince. You had all these people like DJ Reddy Red, and all these people helped building these pieces to the puzzle. Tobin, when did you get introduced to Master P and No Limit Records?
Yeah, early 1990s, E-40's uncle, St. Charles. I don't know if you're familiar with St. Charles, but
yeah, shout out to St. Charles.
Absolutely.
Hell
so
yeah.
St. Charles had connected me because P was just starting out within a minute, Mama's Bad Boy, Getaway Clean, doing all those things, and he was looking to expand his business. So what happened was, you know, he had the street hustler's mentality, but you know, Saint thought that if we connected together, we could really build something really big. But my foundation of business and business strategies and how to get to market and his ability to hustle and his way to get out in front of people and really tell his story, Saint thought that both of us getting together would really form a fantastic team. And so the early part of the 1990s, right around the time before, you know, The Ghetto's Trying to Kill Me came out, and we were working together on some other projects. And then we kind of connected to putting together the West Coast Bad Boys. And that's kind of how, you know, he and I kind of connected through St. Charles.
Yeah. St. Charles, a lot of people don't realize, you know, that's how the Dayton family, I believe, was put on the Down South Hustlers compilation, if I'm not mistaken, because they knew St. Charles, and St. Charles knew T for you.
Yes.
So, yeah. So, A-Ball,
you know, going through that process with the yeah, absolutely. So going through the Down South Hustlers, and we can kind of get into that and putting that record together, the Dayton family and their relationship with St. Charles was a huge part of getting that done. And then, you know, our introduction to Tony Draper and being able to get 8-Ball and MJG on the record, and then a lot of underground artists that you know, we were able to kind of build a relationship with some of those underground artists like 20 to Life and get them on there. We had all of our artists on there, you know. But, you know, you're getting, you know, Mia X and the Beast by the Pounds guy did production on there, and then obviously hooking up with UGK. We spent a lot of time with UGK recording the Down South Hustlers and Pimp C and Bun B, and, you know, we brought them out to California, had them, you know, put them up in California, and we did some recording, and we did something legendary with that Down South Hustlers, that's for sure.
CCG too, by the day.
Absolutely. CCG was like, you know, connecting with CCG and on that project and getting them out there and what those guys did, and then releasing their album independently to some really great fanfare. Those guys, real talented, Court Dog, Big Court now, Cisco, those guys, you know, those guys were so talented, doing their own production, writing their own lyrics. I mean, I can't tell you enough about how incredible, you know, that group was and what they were capable of doing.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Court Dog, you know, he went on to do some solo stuff and eventually became you know, big in the film.
Yeah.
But these guys, you know what I'm saying, these guys were all kids. You know what I'm saying? And you saw something in all these guys, man. What was the chemistry like, you know what I'm saying, you know, between the No Limit and the artists back in the Richmond days, you know, with King George and, you know what I'm saying, all these guys were there.
Well, you know, everybody was just on a mission to kind of get to the next level. So, you know, when you think about it, Master P had this whole vision of just taking over the industry. So he had the reason why we came together and did the West Coast Bad Boys, for example. P had this idea, and we kind of got together and like, okay, how can we blow this thing up? We know we have something. We know we have talent. We know we have these artists. And it's really about connecting with different artists from different hoods all over the West Coast, right? So we you know, like you got JT the Biggest Figure in San Francisco and SIBO up in Sacramento and, you know, and Master P holding Richmond down, and you got the Delinquents in Oakland. And, you know, when you have all these different artists who are popular in their particular hood and you have one individual who's putting this compilation together and people see, you know, Master P is a leader of this West Coast Bad Boy movement. And so if somebody who was in San Francisco was big on JT and they heard and they were going to go buy this album anyway, if somebody was high on the Delinquents out of Oakland or somebody was big on SIBO, those guys are going to go buy their album to find their favorite artist, to listen to their favorite artist. So then what would happen is, if they happen to like a Master P song, or they happen to like a SIBO song, or a Sean T, or a Pizzo, or whoever else that was on that album, the feel was like, man, we're exposing these other artists to this whole fan base they never have before. So us coming together, us spending time, a ton of time in the studio, recording a lot of music. As you know, Master P is known for, you know, recording a lot of songs and trying to get things done quickly and getting it out to market, marketing projects before they come out, you know, getting pre-orders done. So back then, and the retailers knew who we were. So I think the kind of the early days was all of us were on a mission. We're rolling up our sleeves. We're trying to figure out what direction we're going to go. And it was like, how do we make the most bang for our buck is getting on the road, meeting new and upcoming artists, putting them on projects together, just and getting that out to the marketplace, to the retailers.
Yeah. I understand these the criminal minds. I see a lot of people on it. You got even some unknown people now, like Gangsta T or Kelly G, and you got a Big Ed, Tyson J, or King George, of course.
Yeah.
You got people who was not in front. Mm-hmm. It was on Inhumanity Records. Can you tell us about the label Inhumanity Records too, back in the day, before the deal with the big label too?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the artists, you know, that we worked with, and you know that, you know, King George and Big Ed and Cali G and all these guys, you know, it was like a friendship level, right? Everybody's friends, and we're just trying to make something happen. We knew we had lightning in a bottle, if you will, and we just got excited about what we were doing. So, you know, King George and Master P knew each other back from New Orleans. You know, P was going to he was going to school out in the Bay and met Big Ed, and meeting these guys, it was more of those things where Master P had the retail store and he wanted to turn that into a record label, and me being a part of that mix too is like, okay, how do we, you know, we're friends, why don't we make some money? We're good. All of us know each other. All of us feel like we're family. Let's go out here and just turn that into a business that where hopefully everybody gets an opportunity to eat. I mean, that's really what it was about. You know, obviously with C Murder and C Murder, you know, eventually, you know, having his own brand and kind of doing his own thing and blowing up, you know, just the multi-talented individuals all from different areas. But they kind of came together because they were friends and they became friends. And it was that common theme of music, right? The common thing of gangster rap music. And you know, many of the people that are in the crew had something to say, and they all had their kind of, you know, talents. Like Ed was really good. Ed was a really good lyricist and could rap over a hip hop beat or could rap over a gangster rap beat. And King George had that real rough, harsh voice. Cali G was really, he was a real street hustler. So he was able to, you know, kind of tell these stories that were happening in Richmond. So that's kind of how everybody came together on that.
Yeah. Did you meet up Cibo and Master P? Master J? Or was it someone known us?
Yeah. I mean, what do you mean as far as the relationship or...
For the deal, that's how we break bread on
TRU2. Yeah, so, you know, this is how we break bread, West Coast Bad Boys, putting that project together. So everything that we did was based on the compilation of building the Master P brand and the Master P name. Like, it could have been anyone's, but, you know, Master P was in the forefront of this, you know, his money, my money, trying to put this thing together to take it to the next level. And him, you know, building relationships with all these producers, right? People like Ken Franklin, K. Lou, Al Eaton, and the foundation of a West Coast sound before we even went down south to do the Down South Hustlers. You know, we obviously built relationships with the guys from Beast by the Pound, Moby Dick, who I know you guys had on before, is because Moby Dick is Masterpiece cousin, and bringing him into the fold and his you know, production ability. Mr. Servon kind of connected us with KLC and Mia X, and we were able to kind of sign those guys because you figure the mid-90s when we went through this, we had this name, we were selling records, people knew who we were, But then what we did by going back to the roots of New Orleans, and we spent a lot of time in New Orleans signing Mia X, signing Servon, signing KLC, signing Carlos Stevenson, signing, you know, it's just bringing those guys onto the fold, Moby Dick, to have the right sound that's going to blow us up, right? So you got this, you know, you've got this down south underground sound, you got this West Coast sound, and the whole plan was to, how do we bridge the gap between the South and the West in order for us to kind of take over two regions of a country and have a sound that is just different? I mean, if you listen to it now, the No Limit sound, when you hear that hear those tracks, you know, okay, that's a No Limit sound, whether it's a West Coast beat or whether it's a Beats by the Pounds record. And that's really what the focus was, is how do we bridge the gap? And because we didn't want to be just local, right? There's a lot of people who have a specific sound and they're just local. They rap in front of their crowd and they make $2. What we're trying to do is be moguls, right? We're trying to go from the South, trying to go to the West, trying to crack our way into, how do we get into that Midwest so people know who we are and what we're doing? And the more that we were out traveling, because we hit the road, because the number one thing that artists didn't do back then, they kind of stayed in their own environment and didn't hit the road. And one thing that was great about Master P, I will tell you this, working with him, he's the hardest working guy you'll ever meet. There's not a guy out there. I never worked with James Brown because they say he's the hardest working man in show business. But I will tell you, there's nobody, that, at least in the rap game, that worked harder than Master P. Like, I could call Master P up and tell him, hey, we need to be in Florida tomorrow. He would say, what time are you picking me up? And that's the work ethic. That's who he was. He didn't care about anything else. He didn't care about his personal life. He didn't care about, honestly, burning bridges, which was a challenge for him later on, as you guys probably know. He was focused on what is it going to take to get to the top, and he was going to outwork everybody.
I'm glad you said that, because first off, Mr. Servon said, what's up? I'm talking to him online.
Tell him what's up. That's my boy.
We'll do. We had him on the show. One of the times we had him on, he was talking about pretty much like what it was like a day in the life to be running around with Master P. Like he said, this guy had no quit. He would go from one place to the next, and he would hardly sleep and get up and just do it all over again. How was it to try to keep up with Master P in those early days?
Well, I think for me it was, I was kind of used to that kind of environment of sleeping, like even nowadays, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours sleep, if that. And, you know, my mind, I think the reason why we worked so well together and we had the success is because my mind worked like his. I was always thinking of new ideas and new things for us to do, something that made us different than the normal, right? The other thing was, like, He didn't let anything get in his way. So, you know, we'd start our day, you know, anywhere between 4 and 7 a.m. and we end our day anywhere between midnight and 3 a.m. So me going to pick him up, us going to the studio, us visiting distributors, us being on the road, you know, sometimes we'd have folks with us traveling with us and they'd be like, you know, I would have to remind him, hey, you know, we got to make sure people eat, right? You know, because he would just not stop. He would say, hey, we can pick something up and keep going. Even in the studio, spending hours and hours and hours in the studio, making sure that we had enough music. So what we always wanted to do, and the great thing about Master P, was always about value add to the consumer. You know, back then you had major labels, and when they had their artists, they'd give you 10 to 14 songs, right? 14 would be stretching it, but most of the time with 10 to 12 songs on a major artist. Well, Master P wanted to make sure that, you know, if we could give them 18, 19, 22, how many ever numbers that would fit on the CD, we want to make sure that the consumer, the fan, got their money's worth. So, and from a quality perspective, when you look at the quality of the product, you know, now you could say, hey, I like the Dre record better than P, or I like the Ghetto Boys better than P. But when you looked at the graphics, right, and you heard the quality of the music, whether you liked his music or liked what we were doing or not, didn't matter. the quality of it, you're like, man, I'm getting my value and I'm getting my money's worth. So days start out, you know, anywhere between 4 and 7 in the morning, hitting the studio, going to distributors, going to retail stores, then what I would call phone blocking, where we're calling up retail stores just to make sure they have the record. If they don't have the record, make sure they're ordering, setting up promotional parties, you know, also going, connecting with new artists. Like, you know, you're talking about anywhere between a 16-hour day to a 20-hour day. And it's nonstop. And if you didn't have energy, you kind of fell by the wayside. So oftentimes, you know, Servon will tell you, you know, we start the day early in the morning and we'd end late at night and everybody would be dead tired and we go home, sleep, and do it over again the next day. So that's the thing that I think that, you know, there's a lot of things going back and forth about Master P and who he is and what he did. But I will tell you, no one will ever be able to say that they outworked him at anything he did. Some of the decisions that he made, you know, some people don't agree with, you know, or the direction he's taken things, some people don't agree with. But no one who's even people who've had issue with him, no one will ever tell you that he wasn't a hard worker and he didn't drive success by outworking the next person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I'll tell you what, Tobin, we're going to go to a break real quick. Man, this is – and we could talk to you for a long time. We had Doug Young on a couple weeks back, who was a promoter for all that early NWA stuff. And just the stories you guys have is amazing. But we're gonna go to one of these old tracks we were talking about. Here's Mama's Bad Boy, Master P. We'll be right back with Tobin Cosby.
Five kids in the house with no food to eat. So me and my brother, we took to the dope street. You see, that's how the whole gang started. And if a sucker talk shit, I had to get retarded. Paranoid as fuck, so my life changed. Once a school kid, but now I'm selling cocaine. I'm like a Porsche moving fast in a dope game. I started living, now I'm supplying those things. In other words, I'm a kingpin. But in this game, you see, it makes no sense. But just the other day, my brother got shot. I met his funeral on his casket, I'm dropping rocks. Sister crying and mom's going crazy. My Uncle Marvin and Vice couldn't even faze me. I'm on a mission, I got a job to complete. They take one of mine, I'm putting six of them to sleep. So I live by the gap, now that's my toy. And out on the streets, I'm a bad boy. Life I live as a juvenile. Grew up in the ghetto, back in the cellar. Your parents did not concern it to melt. At the time I was tripping, cause we were struggling every day. Took to the streets and did a lick and got quick paid. I live like a trine, but now I'm lost like a giant. I'm saying fuck the police because I'm police defined. Don't give a fuck about nothing but my meal and my family. I took to the streets because my mom, she couldn't handle me. I'm crazy as fuck, you better duck when my nines out. Regret my life, you lose yours, that's how you find out. That I'm a real motherfucker, sucker, test me. Pop and nine is one life less. I'm jacking and stealing and killing and killing caps with text and nines and Uzis. Yeah, that's how I'm feeling. Shiesty friends of mine that's tripping every day. They wonder why the P put some heads away. In other words, I live by the gap, now that's my toy. And out on the streets, I'm Mama's bad boy.
Sometimes it's hard being me, but you make it someday.
that's back when No Limit was more G-Funk than Crunk, you know what I'm saying? Straight from Richmond. At this time period, you know, when Mama's Bad Boy was out, Tobin, were you guys, you know what I'm saying, anticipating, you know what I'm saying, a deal with Priority that early on? Or was it not till, you know, 99 Ways to Die, Ghetto Tried to Kill Me, did you guys know you had it locked in?
Well, we knew after Mama's Bad Boys is really the thing what we wanted to do was just more like increase our revenue and increase our income, right? After that, when the Ghetto's Trying to Kill Me came out, that's when things really, it was like, okay, we could go get a deal and make some things happen. So when the Ghetto's Trying to Kill Me came out and we started working on the West Coast Bad Boys compilation and really connecting with all of the popular, you know, artists on the West Coast, mainly in the Bay Area, that's when we knew, okay, we could go get a deal. And we started getting phone calls from all kinds of record labels, East Coast, West Coast, that wanted to do business with us. And some of the deals that came across the table financially, up the advance money was solid. Looking at, you know, a high six figure, close to seven figure advance money, but we couldn't, you know, the thought process was we wouldn't be able to control who we are. And we had different discussions around, do we sacrifice the Master P name, but as long as we keep No Limit separate, does Master P sign as an artist with one of these other labels on the East Coast or down in the West Coast? And then we use the money from the Master P artist name and getting that out in the major label to spend in the No Limit to really building the No Limit foundation to make it into a high power record label. So I would say more along the lines after Mama's Bad Boy, and when we start putting the West Coast Bad Boys, and then when the West Coast Bad Boys hit Billboard charts, we were in that we were in the top 100, top 200 on the pop charts, and then the top 100 on the R&B hip hop charts. That's when we knew, we're like, okay, people are calling, we've got something here, we're on the road. We're going to shows, and we're opening up for larger artists. We're going to shows. We're doing our in stores where we're signing autographs, and they're literally closing down stores and closing down areas because so many people were in on the No Limit and the Master P movement, and that's when we kind of knew we had something.
So he you know, the West Coast, it really is what enabled him to blow up and go down south, as everybody knows. At what point in time did you guys realize that you could walk into Priority Records and get like a, what was it, like an 80-20 deal?
Yeah,
which was
so
unheard of.
80-20 deal. Well, the thing is, we were making money. I mean, and I honestly thought we kind of jumped the gun because we could have probably did something a little bit different, but we did an 80-20 deal with them because at the time, they were looking for their next. They were looking for their next show, right? They're looking for their next artist and label to take them to the next level. I think the biggest part of what that deal was is they knew we had a lot of content. They knew we were doing projects that the world wanted to hear, and it was so gritty and so underground. And we had already coming off the West Coast Bad Boys. People were waiting for. People were waiting for the Ice Cream Man. They were waiting for a new TRU record, and they were waiting for a Down South Hustlers record. So those were three records that they already knew. We had already had pre-orders for those albums, right? So back then what we used to do, we used to go to the retail store, put together one sheets. We used to talk to the retailers about these projects, and then we would pre-order it. So we would do pre-marketing in those retail stores because a lot of times back then they had displays, they had the books and the marketing materials, the marketing flyers that they would send out to customers, or they would have where people could see what records are coming out. So what would happen is we create such a buzz in those retail stores, we would get orders, and the retailers would come to us and say, when is this album going to be done? Because I've got so many people asking about it. I want 100,000 copies, right? So when you're looking at, you know, 100,000 copies and you're talking like over $1 million in billing, we're already, you know, we're in pretty good shape. you know? And I think for us, it was about what do we need to do to get us out nationally? So, you know, we're working with St. Charles. We're working with City Hall Records. We're working with Southwest Wholesale and Selected Hits and those smaller distributors. Yeah, I mean, and you know, Gonzalez as well and all those folks, so we're working with them. But we wanted to be able to drop an album nationally and know that it's in every system and in every store, and we'll be able to have enough coverage to, if we went down to Miami, Florida, we had an album that was in a retail store, because that's half the battle. The biggest thing that people, that artists didn't realize, like, look, once you get in the system, you're able to push those records to the retailers. And I think what happened so much, people didn't spend enough time with building a relationship with the retailers. Now, we did it kind of backwards. We spent more time developing relationships with the retailers to make sure we have product available than we did on the radio station at the front end. So most artists back then, they would say, or labels, they would go to the record store or the radio stations and try to get play. And for us, we're like, look, we could have the hottest record out there ever, but if we're not in the retail stores, have a good relationship with these retail stores, we're not going to sell anything. So we already would go out, we get these pre-orders, we would sell these records, and we had success. So it was easy to have a conversation for priority to say, hey, it's not going to cost you anything. You're just going to press some product to put in the stores. We're going to do our own marketing strategies. We're going to deal with the retailers. You just need to make sure the record's in the store. And for them, it was a win-win situation, right? They didn't really have to give us any money. We weren't really in a situation where we were hurting, you know. We weren't at the level we wanted to be at, but it wasn't like we were going to starve to death. And at the end of the day, for priority, they needed something that was hot. And this, for them, it's volume, right? So, you know, we'd have 20, 22 albums ready to go, and we'd have to tweak them and stuff, but we'd have them slated. And for them, they're like, okay, you've got 22 albums. It might clog up our distribution system a little bit, but for the most part, we're going to be able to move some units and make some things happen. So that's kind of, you know, that was kind of how we were able to kind of walk through the door and say, hey, this is what we're looking for. We're not looking for much for you. Most artists who were coming in the door who wanted them to pay for everything were in a different situation where they're going to get 8 to 12% of their record because they're asking for the priority to do everything. We kept our own publishing. We owned the rights to the records. All we needed was them to put it in the retail store so we could generate revenue from through sales.
Yeah. Also, they will be recognized in the early days because at the time, Master P and True, on the very did all the shows, the live shows, even for free. And so all those Bay Area rappers won't do that, so they'll be known everywhere in the Bay, right?
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that was great about P would give, you know, he would give free shows. He would give away things for free. We always, like, you know, I kind of came up with the concept. We wanted to give out go-karts and these tanks and all these promotional parties and all this stuff. We were doing stuff for free just to get our name out there. So we would, from a T-shirt perspective, we'd go do a concert and give away 200 or 300 T-shirts, 100% cotton, pre-shrunk, highest quality ever. You know, other artists are giving out those shirts that you wash it one time and then you're going to use it to wash your car forever, right? And what we were doing is putting out such high-quality product that when we would go to a town and we do a promotional thing and we have some of the flyest T-shirts you can imagine, we'd go back, you know, 6 months, 3 months, 5 months later, and people were still wearing the shirt because it was quality. And that's how we started building relationships with people and building our fan base and our fan club, because we'd start sending out information about new projects, right? Oh, be a part of the No Limit Soldiers. Help us promote. You could get gear, get free gear, and trying to create this kind of atmosphere that everyone was on our team. And that's really how we did it, which is a little bit different than other folks were just hiring people. We have people doing things for us for free just because they wanted to be a part of the movement. We did shows for free because we wanted to show people showcase who we are and who our artists were. We would do a lot of retail parties where we would go to a retail store. We would cater barbecue and then outside put up a stage and we perform, and then we'd give out a bunch of T-shirts, and then people would buy CDs and all that stuff, and just created this party atmosphere that people were on this movement and they wanted to be a part of something special. And that's really how we kind of grew that No Limit Soldier, No Limit Family, you one of our No Limit Soldiers, and getting people excited about who we are and what we did.
Created a team.
Absolutely.
I remember we had Kay Lou on the show, and Kay Lou said that they did the Ice Cream Man in like a weekend. How fast did you guys actually get that record done?
Well, it was probably more like 3 or 4 days, but it was something like that. So what Kay Lou did, he made, I don't even know, and this back then we were using cassettes, right? He made about 30 or 40 tracks. And what we did was listen to the ones that we wanted for the album and said, okay, here are the 12 or whatever we wanted from him. We had some that we wanted from Moby Dick and all. So we took all those songs and we had already written to all that stuff. So we had at least concepts, most of the lyrics. And then basically what we did in a matter of 3 days, I think we started out on a Thursday, and we just recorded and recorded and recorded. And by that Sunday, we were pretty much done. The only thing that needed to be done was the mixing aspect, but the recording of the album was about 3 days. Maybe four, but it was about 3 or 4 days. So to kind of piggyback of what Kay Lou said, yeah, we recorded that album in a weekend. We recorded the TRU True album. That was about 5 days. Like, one thing about what we were doing, we were recording fast. And then if we had somebody, what we would do is take a record and listen to it. We do a rough mix on it and say, we don't like that. I think King George would sound good on this record. I think Big Ed would sound good on this record. Hey, I'd like to put Mia X on this track. Like, if you listen to No Limit Records for any of the projects that we had, and even, towards the end of the 90s, 99, in that area, all of the tracks, and it's kind of all the tracks sound similar, because we would record all these records and then say, okay, these 15 or 20 are going to go on Big Ed's album. These 15 or 20 are going to go for Moby Dick's album. These 15 or 20 are going on P's album or Silk's album or whatever. And that's why the No Limit sound, a lot of those records sounded alike. So as much as it was great from generating this movement, it kind of hindered, towards the tail end of the success of No Limit. Most of the albums, a lot of the albums sounded a lot alike, because a lot of using the same producers, not venturing out to do something a little bit different. So it was like, yeah, it was a double-edged sword. It's like, yeah, we were recording a lot of albums and putting them out, but at the same time, a lot of them started to sound, sound-wise repetitive. Even though we were talking about different things, the music itself kind of sounded repetitive.
Yeah, Ken Franklin was very important in the earlier No Limit days, because it was the bop song, the bop shit. It was before Kelsey, before Moby Dick. So Ken Franklin and Kay Lou defined the No Limit Bay Area song earlier.
Kay Lou was a... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Kay Lou was as a producer, I mean, he's a real musician. Moby Dick as a producer is a real musician, and KLC, and those guys are real musicians. So when you take a look at Kay Lou and what he was doing in that West Coast sound and that high pitched organ and making sure that sound was different, it had its own sound. And then when we did more Southern records, when we did the Down South Hustlers, it was more of a Down South feel, and having someone like Pimp C produce a couple tracks, and Bun B rapping on it. I mean, that Player from the South Stack of G's is probably one of the best records ever put out and ever produced by Pimp C, just because the collaboration between him and Bun and P and them being on the West Coast and not – and spending – I mean, we spent weeks and weeks together. We would do pool parties and those and promote and have people come in and bikini contests and doing all kinds of things and spending so much time together. We really got a chance to kind of build that relationship and kind of grow together. And that's the thing. It's like you got somebody like K-Lou who – you know, for us, we were doing tracks with K-Lou. We were just, hey, just send us beats, give us beats, and we'll do what we need to do or put that together. So we listened to as many tracks as possible. So when we went into the studio, we just knock it out. So I think that's the thing, is having that specific sound, West Coast and down south sound, but also being able to put records out really quick, flood the market. So we're eating up the market because we had so much different, you know, our sounds different, our products different, and what we were doing was kind of on another level, and that's why, you know, the whole No Limit scene blew up.
Yeah. Do you know why Master P and Pepsi got a follow up later?
I mean, you know, look, I can't really say 100% other than, you know, Pimp C had some demons, P had some demons, some things were said, and then they kind of got into it. I mean, before Pimp C died, they kind of, you know, hashed it out and they were cool and everything was good. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, everyone's young, everyone's got this kind of mindset, there's egos involved, and sometimes people just, they just fall out. I mean, I know, sometimes it just is what it is. I think, you know, to me, Pimp C was just real. He was like one thing about him, he was 120% real. He never pulled any punches. If he didn't like something, he'd tell you he didn't like it. And he had no problem. He didn't care who you were. And he just kept it real. And, you know, sometimes, you know, people don't like hearing some real things that are real. And sometimes, you know, people say things and they just kind of get into these conflicts. And that's just how it is. It's unfortunate. That's just how the game is, right? The game is, you know, everyone's ego. They think they're better than the next person. If they're not getting what they think they should get, you know, people get upset. And sometimes they're really getting shortchanged, you know. And if you feel you're getting shortchanged or you're really getting shortchanged, sometimes people just decide to move on to a different level, to something on different. That's just kind of how it works.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and you hear that a lot, and, you know, in the rap game, you know, especially because, you know, especially with, you know, No Limit, there's a lot of money involved. You know what I'm saying? At what point in time did you say, you know what, I'm gonna step away? I might do stuff with, you know, like Lil Troy and other artists. When did you leave the No Limit?
So basically, towards the end of '96, that beginning of '97. You know, I didn't see eye to eye with what the direction things were going. And I mean, and I think what, if you talk to anybody like Beast by the Pound, those guys were sheltered against what really was going on. And they didn't find out what was really going on as far as direction and where money was placed and all kinds of things until later on. And for me, it was more about me. You know, I had a ton of ideas of things that I wanted to do that I wanted to take to the next level. And we, you know, the big concept of going direct to DVD, that was my idea because, you know, we couldn't get, no one wanted to work with us from a film perspective until I said to P, well, why do we need them? We can use our retail prowess and our distribution through retail to do our own movie and blow it up. And that's kind of the direction we went. And then obviously the movies and all that came from there. But it just came a time for me just to kind of move on and do something different. And, you know, I was, at the end of the day, King George wanted to move on and I wanted to move on. Actually, Big Ed had a plan on moving on before any of us. And the conversation with Ed was like, look, let's just stick around and kind of see if things change or become different before we make a move. And you know, Big Ed decided he wanted to, you know, stick around and good for him. And I think it worked out for him for the most part towards the end of his life, unfortunately. Rest in peace, Big Ed. you know, King and I, we ventured out off on our own. And I think that what we were able to do, you know, with us kind of just going out on our own without any sort of deal, distribution deal, and being able to continuously hit the Billboard top 200, top 100, and sell a lot of records and travel all over the world and be in the top 20 and over in Japan and being able to do the things we were doing, we kind of, you know, made our own name for ourselves as we slid up from underneath the No Limit umbrella. And then also at the same time connecting with Little Troy and, you know, putting out his album independently, you know, and being in the top 30, being number 26 on the Billboard charts and being one of the hottest records to come out at the, you know, 98, 99, and everywhere, you know, everybody heard Wanna Be a Baller. Like it was the biggest record out there. Yeah. So for us to be able to, you know, in me through my label, be able to put out, you know, Shortstop Records and put that album out with Lil Troy was huge, because prior to that, Lil Troy had his label and, you know, he was doing some things like Mass 187 and had a couple things out, but, you know, absolutely. Mass 187, really talented cat, but he hadn't had the success with putting those albums out until we kind of connected and we formulated a game plan of how we were going to put that record out. And Sitting Fat Down South just became a huge hit, and we kind of just kept rolling from there.
Yeah, you did also PMP, Pan, or Fan Band Play, Ray to Win. He was an executive producer on the distribution of CCG2, 100 Games.
Yeah, so I'll put
a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a big chart population.
If you look at it, it's been about, we put the Wet Boys out, you know, 45 albums, right? You know, so we put out 45 albums. CCG was a great project for us, and we were real happy with what we did with that. We were real happy with, you know, what we did with Little Troy, and then piggybacking off of what we did with Little Troy and putting out that PMP Pain album, which was a huge, huge record down south for us. I mean, you know, Fam Bam Click was a huge, you know, we did this Way Too Real record where Fam Bam Click and their Crips and like, man, it was like they had this whole Crip movement behind them and what we did with that record. So, I mean, we had a lot of success independently. And then think about this. We didn't have a Priority Records or Universal Records or any of that thing. We were doing everything through Selected Hits and Southwest Wholesale. And if you look at all the albums we had, there were times we'd have four or five albums out on Billboard charts, and we had the success. And I think if we would have had an umbrella like a Universal, I think we could have expanded even more on what we did, because we had, you know, I had a ton of ideas about some things that I wanted to do. But I felt that the foundation that we laid at No Limit Records, and then working with all these different artists and doing compilations and doing projects like the Down South Hustlers, the West Coast Bad Boys, it was a good opportunity. I mean, you know, there was a time when we were trying to work with Cash Money when I was at No Limit. I was, you know, trying to do a deal with those guys at Cash Money to do a distribution deal with Cash Money Records would come out through No Limit. And, you know, you know, that's one of those things where, you know, Cash Money decided not to come through No Limit and work with us, and they did their own thing at Universal. And Windy Day set those guys up with a huge deal that was some next level stuff, and they were fortunate to
they were
going to take
go
that and run with
first.
It.
They,
oh
not,
yeah,
not you have to tell them they were going to go with No Limit. How deep were you guys in the talks with Cash Money? Because you know they had a huge base in New Orleans, and what made them go elsewhere?
Well, I think, I mean, I can't really speak from their perspective, but we were, you know, we had multiple conversations with them. Servom actually is the one kind of connected all of us about, and we sat down a couple times and talked about doing some stuff and doing a distribution deal. And we talked about, hey, let us do, we've got a really large distribution arm, let us work with you guys. I connected those guys with Wendy Day. Like, Wendy Day had never really knew who they were, and I, you know, connected them with Wendy Day. I connected DJ Screw with Wendy Day. And so I don't know how close we were, to be honest with you guys. Like, but I know, you know, we had those conversations, and it was kind of like, yeah, you know, what, you know, my conversation with those guys, like, look, if we got together, we could take over the entire industry. Like, there would never be a need for a major label. We could do some really incredible things. And I can't really say why they didn't do it. Part of that is they wanted to have their own vision and do their own thing. And I'm sure when you're talking about, you talk about Baby and Slim and P and myself and our, what we thought way things should go and what they thought things should go, you know, sometimes people don't get on the same page. So they a few months later went to Universal and got a really huge deal. And now that, you know, they've blown up and everybody knows who they are and what they're doing. I mean, I'm not for sure if they would have signed with No Limit, would they have had the same success they would have now? I mean, you know, it's hard to say. Probably not. But because they went and ventured out on their own, they've been huge in what they've done, and people know who they are, and you know, they've had a big, they, you know, Cash Money had their own movement, right? So it's a little bit different if Cash Money is underneath No Limit, and you know, Cash Money doesn't have their own movement. They're part of the No Limit movement, right? That's what people would think, even though they have their own sound or they're doing something different. If they're underneath a No Limit umbrella, which is underneath a Priority umbrella, they are, first you're cutting into the piece of the pie, right? They're not making the most that they can make. That's first and foremost. The second is people will always think of them as, oh, man, that's that No Limit crew, Cash Money Records. So that's probably a lot of reason why they didn't make that move in transition. They decided to go off to Universal, and they blew up. They were, you know, those guys are talented. They're hardworking, and you know, they did what they needed to do. And go ahead.
Oh no, that's why you created Me and Mine Entertainment in '98, your old label.
Yeah. So after I left, you know, I created Me and Mine Entertainment. You know, and part of that was putting out King George and putting his Life of the Kingpin album out, putting out Players and Hustlers, King George's Soldiers. Also putting out, which we were talking about before, the Little Troy album through Shortstop Records and Me and Mine Entertainment, and blowing that record out. And the crazy thing is, anyone that works at Universal will tell you that's the most profitable album Universal's ever had. Because the only thing they did was change the artwork and take a few songs off, and move that album, and it just continued to sell. You know, I think it's probably close to two million sold by now. So
and
I mean
put,
that
put out,
one thing.
Yeah, you put out also Wet Boys, it's a group of Sporty G. Sporty G was a legendary new and rapper. So
yes,
Evan,
that Wet Boys album was something. You know, the interesting thing, you know, and Sporty T passed away too. Rest in peace to Sporty T. But we put that, you know, those guys came to me and said, hey, Sporty T came to me and said, hey, I got this album. And the unfortunate part of it was a big diss record of Cash Money guys. And they asked me to put the record out. And I was like, well, the record's banging, but it's a beef record. And my thing was like, well, are you concerned about putting this beef record out? Like for me as a distributor and a record label, I didn't really care because I didn't have any fight in it either way. It was more of a business deal, and I thought the record had legs and they were talented, and I thought the record should come out. And, you know, Sporty T was like, no, it's all good. You know, we just, you know, we out here, you know, trying to get our money, and we're out here, you know, just, you know, kind of, you know, banging on wax, if you will, whatever. And, you know, we put that album out, and DJ Screw actually did a screwed version for me, one of the last records he screwed before he passed away, or full records. We did a Get Wet, Get Screwed. So we had the regular version selling and the screwed versions, the Get Wet, Get Screwed version selling at the same time. So that record was a huge success. And then Sporty T wound up doing a deal with Master P for the single Soldier Rag. and Master P put up the money to shoot the video, put money in 40T's pocket, and Master P put the money up to put that video out, Soldier Rag video. And, you know, that was a local sensation and a big hit. But, you know, that's kind of, you want to talk about, you know, transition from us putting out the album to Sporty T doing a remix and do, and putting a single out on a compilation that Master P spent money on.
Yeah, and so you drop the Northeast Killers, that back in the weekend, so,
yeah. Yeah, so, G-Lo, you know, I did
also
a record
G-Lo.
Black Market. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, okay. G-Lo, the No Face Killers album, you know, we had Brother Lynch Hung on that record. I think X-Rated was on that record. So there was a, we had a lot of people on that No Face Killer sound, No Face Killers compilation. That was big. I did a G-Lo record. I mean, there's so many albums that I've produced, and as a producer and an executive producer, getting out to the world. And I think a lot of people know the story of me being behind No Limit and kind of putting the foundation together to get them to the next level, and then me venturing off on my own and having success. And you know, you think about one of the biggest records in 1999. Sitting Fat Down South, Wanna Be a Baller was one of the biggest records. I mean, there was a time that album was outselling, you know, Tupac albums when Tupac came out with a new album after he had already passed, obviously. And, you know, our records outselling that and having that good foundation in Texas. So I spent a lot of time and effort into building relationships with a lot of folks and meeting a lot of folks and spending time in Tennessee and spending time in Texas and spending time in California and Florida. And so it's like building those relationships, building relationships with retailers and making sure that those records got out. So I was just really blessed to work with a lot of talented people who kind of saw my vision of really getting records out.
Yeah. Yeah. Great thing. Also you released Got a Boy, for sure. You get a lot of catalog. Yes. And also you made the magazine Hip Hop Guys of World at the time. So.
I put together with Mongo Nicole and Waylon Southern, we put together a project called Hip Hop Versus the World, a magazine. It is, you know, it was, we spent some time with Tribe Called Quest and you know, De La Soul in putting together that project. So, you know, a little bit of everything, putting together a magazine, putting together, you know, the albums, working on, you know, a movie and putting movies and projects together. It's a combination of all those things that we kind of put together on that.
Yeah. Also, you graduated to Spokane University, so you will be able to ever make a thesis on the African-American in the journalism. Can you tell us about this one too?
So I went to Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, and part of that, you know, going to school there, developing a rap show, you know, in a matter of, you know, predominantly Caucasian area, where people were kind of wanting to listen to rap music, listen to hip hop, and being in college on a college radio station right close to downtown Spokane, I was able to kind of, and that's really how I started to break in with from the label perspective, is being able to play this music that no one else is playing in the whole entire city, you know? So, you know, underground music that no one ever heard of. Like at that time in Spokane, no one had ever heard of E-40. I'm the one who broke E-40's record out in Spokane, Washington, because nobody had ever heard of him. I'm the one who broke out Sebo's record because no one ever heard of him. So my relationship with St. Charles and producers like Larry D, I was able to break these artists that no one had really heard of, but they started to build this really buzz. Like right now, you know, E-40 could go to Washington State and he would sell out pretty much almost any venue because so many people love him because he, you know, his foundation and what he's done and who he is. So when I think about that, my background in college, you know, kind of going to school there to be an athlete, but, you know, athletics not working out the way I want them to, and realizing that I wanted to be in this music entertainment industry and putting together these projects. I mean, it was kind of, you know, it was an exciting time for me. and then, you know, building my relationship with St. Charles and building my relationship with Master P, and through that, meeting so many people. Like when you think about folks who started their career, many of them started as an intern, right, or going to get coffee for someone or going to pick up their laundry or the dry cleaning. And I literally started in as, you know, once Master P and I hit it off and we started working on projects together in the early 90s, and literally 22, 23 years old, I'm running a record company. By the time I'm 24, is one of the most popular record companies in the world. So, you know, you want to talk about going from 0 to 100 really quickly and, you know, making some mistakes along the way, some bumps and bruises, but also, you know, having some really high successes in a decade where, you know, most 22, 23-year-olds are starting their first job and just trying to figure out what they're doing with their lives and what they're going to be. I was already in it and making moves and kind of building my brand, building the No Limit brand, and then obviously building the Master P brand.
Yeah, it's reminds me the work of Charlie Braxton, you know, from Notre Dame now, bro. Charlie Braxton, who did a lot of work of same with universities too, and he put down the down south music. Which can you tell us about your movie?
Sure. Like, so I mean, Billy, the biggest thing I think for success for me and No Limit Records and me and my entertainment, Shortstop Records, is the ability to get out and be on the road and get in front of people and build relationships with people. You know, the segue into Reverend Durong, the Reverend Durong Ain't Right. You know, Reverend Durong was, you know, was kind of a concept of that crooked reverend who drinks, who smokes, who you know, has, you know, multiple girlfriends, and putting that into a movie concept, it was just something that, you know, I always wanted to do, and I was glad we were able to do it. I was able to become friends with Lester Bibbs, who's a big-time comedian nationally, well-known, travels all over the world, and being able to kind of connect with him to be the star of this movie. And I think the exciting things was having the Mixon brothers from Old School and the Nutty Professor, those big guys, them, and also making sure that, you know, building a relationship with someone like Yo-Yo, where she's in the movie, and, you know, a relationship with Ken Wilson, who was the former president of MCA, and also, you know, he was the senior executive VP over at J Records, and just meeting enough people to kind of put that project together. The W.E. Baker, Bill Baker, was the main producer of that movie. He produced the first Friday. So a lot of the relationships he had from Friday, you know, he was able to introduce me to some of those folks that worked on that project. And, you know, good cinematographers and people that just who knew the industry that could make a good quality project. So right now, movie just dropped on Amazon Video Prime. The Reverend Durong Ain't Right. It's doing well. We're in the top 20 of downloads, sales, and rental on Amazon Video Prime. So we're real happy with that. Trying to crack the top 10. And, you know, and I'm just very, really happy that so many people who knew about the Reverend Durong skits and knew about the name Reverend Durong has decided to come out and just really support the project, and many of the people that were fans of Lester Bibbs in the comedy specials and all the things he was doing and being on Def Comedy Jam, they kind of just, you know, followed suit and kind of followed and jumped on the bandwagon with it. So it's been fantastic. It's been good.
Yeah, Rob Durong movie was named after the classic True.
Yes, absolutely, man. It was, you know, if you listen to the song from the Ghetto's Trying to Kill Me, you listen to all the skits, you know, myself and King George and all of us were Master P. We turned a skit into a full movie. So it was kind of exciting to put that project together and get that done. And it was one of those things where, you know, how do you take this vision I have and turn it into a movie? And it's about getting the right people involved and making sure that they're excited about it and making sure that they are, you know, that they want to make this project happen and make this movie happen. So it's definitely been, you know, an exciting whirlwind where those folks who listened to those projects and knew that, you know, Reverend Durong and Deacon Hot Hands and all the projects that we were, you know, on, people just said, hey, I want to check this movie out just because. So, you know, we decided, you know, I decided, okay, I'm going to make a movie and I'm going to make it exciting and I'm going to make it fun and I'm going to get some established actors that, you know, that you've seen as you, if you watch projects and seen projects, you're like, okay, this is, I know this person or I've seen this person in this movie or this TV show, to make sure that we have some legitimacy and make a project that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. How many times you made the movie? How many times you did it?
Yeah. So yeah, sure. So I've made a few movies, some independent that never, you know, really came to fruition. But this is like being a part of the behind the scenes of the I'm About It movie before it actually came out, and then transitioning out of No Limit. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, I've done three movies. I think this one's really exciting. I've got a couple other movies that I'm working on. Before Fresh Kid Ice died, I was, you know, working on a Two Live Crew movie. We had a script together and we were ready to move forward with the Two Live Crew movie. But unfortunately, Fresh Kid Ice passed away, so that kind of put a halt on everything. Rest in peace, Fresh Kid Ice.
Yeah,
he was a really good friend of mine, and I was sad when he passed away because, you know, we had a lot of different projects we were working on, especially this Two Live Crew movie that we were going to do. And, you know, I spoke to him just a couple days before he passed away, and he seemed like he was in pretty good spirits. So when he passed, I knew he was sick, but I just thought it was something he would have overcome. But, it's one of those things. We had that project. We've got, we got a project called Straight Outta Burbank that we're working on that hopefully we'll be ready to start shooting in 2019. Comedy about three early 40s guys who are one hit wonders who want to get back into the game. So it's kind of a, you know, one guy's a assistant principal, one guy sells insurance, another guy's a stay at home dad. So it's kind of a very funny comedy that we're working on. We got another movie that we'll be shooting towards the end of 2019 called The Happy Ending. It's about two guys on house arrest and them getting into a little bit of trouble while they're on house arrest. So, you know, working on the movie projects is exciting and it kind of, you know, pumps me up. So it's definitely interesting times and it's a fun time and very exciting.
Man.
Yes, sir.
I'll tell you what, Sylvan, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. I really would love to have you on again in the future because, like I said, we could talk to you for hours, man. so much insight on the game. You've been involved in so many great things. But before we get out of here, you know, if cats want to, you'll get these movies. I know you said they're Amazon and stuff like that. If they want to get at you or anything, maybe I want to give you the floor, man. Let them know how they can get in touch with you, brother.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I appreciate you. You can definitely hit me, Tobin Costin. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. You can shoot me a message there. I got a new hard cider coming out called Psycho. It's Xaiko. And you can hit me at sippsycho.com, info@sippsycho. So it's SIP is SIPXAIKO.com. You can hit me there, but pretty much you can hit me on Instagram, Facebook, at Twitter. I'm just out there. And if anybody wants to shoot at me and just ask me questions or anything I can do to support anybody, let me know. Right now, the next big project I'm working out is March 21st. I'm also a professor at Holy Names University. We're doing a really great event for the Make-A-Wish Foundation on March 21st, an awesome, awesome wrestling match called Hawkmania. And just get at me, man. I'd love to see people and talk to people and anything I can do to support anyone in their career and give them guidance. That's just what I'm here for. It's about giving back and helping people. So Yes, March 21st, Oakland, California, Make-A-Wish Foundation, just trying to grant a wish for a young person, man, and just out here doing it. So I appreciate you guys. What you guys do is phenomenal, giving people who have been in the game a long time a chance to tell their stories, people who've been around, up-and-coming artists who are coming up, give them the talk about their story. I got one – at this stage of the game, I got one artist I'm working with. His name is Kozzy, C-O-Z-Z-Y. He's got some good music that's out there right now on iTunes, working on a new album for him. And, you know, so from an artist music perspective, Kozzy is the only artist I'm working with. But the other thing is just really the movie and giving back with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. So I got a lot of stuff going on, but I just appreciate you guys for giving me the opportunity to kind of just chat with you. And I'm available anytime. Anything I could talk to you guys about or support you, I am all in, guys. Thank you.
Man, thank you so much, Toby, man. If we don't talk to you before, then you have good holidays, brother.
You too, man. Happy holidays to you guys. Be safe out there and keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, man, most of
you
guys. We look forward to part two of this phenomenal interview. And also, please tune in this Friday, 8 p.m. Central. Our own DJ Lord Sinister sat down with Evidence Dilated Peoples, so you don't want to miss that one. We're going to get out of here.
Yes,
Toby Cox, man, you take care, brother. Peace.
You too. Peace out, brother.
You just like.
I'm a 20-inch crawler, but the left or right, I'm out of sight, I'm sold. I'm bouncing off the road, I'm in a modem, and fold, I'm tainted to him. Hop out my big body form, chain with the tongue, can't forgive me what alarm. I'm hot, but I'm looking good, diamonds get some wood. Man, it's understood, got money in my hood. I'm pushing big body, can't stop me. For the 9-8, gotta sell a million copies. I'm a crow slow, puffing on the Optimo, hit the store. I'ma go real slow, puffing on the Optimo. I'ma let the grass green. One more patrol, big green and night for
the team. Wanna be a baller, shot caller, 20-inch blade.
Get the
time, cold phone. Broke a two phone, now you know no dope pigeon. Used to call my throat, now these hoes count my inches. Had to get older, man, it got colder. I done got drunk, got a chip on my shoulder. Licks in Kuwait, got licks in Pakistan. Boys don't understand, virtual alley caravan. Double dose marble flows, naked hoes around me. Every time I come in, I knew they want to sign me. Got the little wheel, diamond grill, them with wind. Blaze in the bin, and can't forget the gin. The booby down the rubies, I'm watching on the movie. Drop the top of sky, then you know I'm in the jacuzzi. Bourbon and I'm swerving, man, it's getting hot. My last name, him, I'm dropping my title off the lot. David Taylor.
I party every day, all day. Ain't no way, boy, can stop. As I slide to your neighborhood, chop, chop, chop. Headed straight to the top. I only play the win, about to close up shop. So tap and dead in, pimp the pin once again. Beat the message I seen. Take the levels that you devil can't comprehend. Big body beat, as I fall through the side. Big